According to an estimate by the National Cancer Institute, there were more than 234,000 diagnosed cases of breast cancer in the United States last year and around 40,000 deaths. Last week, a new study was released that raised questions about the value of mammograms. So for this week's Please Explain, we thought that we'd find out more about the illness and the best ways to detect and treat it. And joining us now is Dr. Larry Norton, Deputy Physician in Chief of Breast Cancer Programs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. And I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show.
Great pleasure to be here.
And we invite you, our listeners, to join in. You can call us at 212-433-9692. If you have a question, you can also write us on our show page or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. So, Dr. Norton, there are a lot of different kinds of cancers. What's the most basic definition of what a cancer is?
You're hitting a really important topic because it's changing rapidly. Cancer is commonly thought of in medicine and in lay circles as a mass, as a tumor. The concept of tumor is everybody thinks it's just a collection of abnormal cells that are starting to grow and go crazy, and that's the current concept. And it's been the concept for hundreds of years. It goes back to Maimonides in terms of defining the difference between cancers and infections. Cancer is much more complicated than that, and actually the complexities may be simplifying in terms of our approach toward eradicating cancer. Obviously, the fundamental unit of cancer is the cancer cell. It's an abnormal cell, and it clearly divides too much. And that's why you get an accumulation of the cancer cells. But in addition to that, it does a lot of other things. And one of the other major things it does is move around. The normal cells of your body stay put. They stay where they're supposed to stay, whereas cancer cells have the capacity of moving through the bloodstream, through the lymphatic stream, and setting up shop in other places.
So when a breast cancer cell moves to the lung, does it become a lung cancer cell, or
no,
does it
still
remain a breast cancer cell?
No. A Frenchman in Detroit is still a Frenchman. Once it's a breast cancer cell, it's always a breast cancer cell. But nobody ever died of cancer cells. Cancer cells are harmless. They're only harmful when they form tumors, and tumors are a collection of cancer cells, white blood cells, blood vessel cells, some of the cells from the organ that it invades. It's a complex social structure, and one of the really exciting things about contemporary cancer research is dissecting the interrelationships between those various cells, and that's giving us a lot of important clues for how we can get rid of the disease.
Is breast cancer a one-size-fits-all term, or are there different kinds of breast cancer?
Well, breast cancer is a cancer that originates in the breast, and when our primary therapy for cancer was local, that is surgery and radiation therapy, the organ that the cells came from was the most important thing. But the fact is that cancer cells are diseases of abnormal DNA fundamentally, and so where the cell comes from is nowhere as important as what's making it behave in an abnormal way.
But if you look at a melanoma cancer cell, it's dark, and that's why it's called melanoma, and it looks different from other cancer cells. If I looked at a breast cancer cell, would I be able to distinguish it from a cancer cell from another kind of cancer?
If you just look at the cell, you can get into the basic ballpark. You'd call it an adenocarcinoma, but to know that it's a breast tumor, it's a breast cancer cell, you have to see its relationship to other cells, such as normal cells of the breast, white cells, and so on. So actually, that's very important because sometimes people get diagnosed with cancer by what's called a fine needle aspiration, where you just look at individual cells, and that's not a good way to do it. You need what's called a core biopsy so you can see its relationship to other cells. It's a very fundamental concept of cancer, is the relationships are as important as the cells themselves.
Now, what is it about breast tissue that makes it susceptible to cancer?
Well, every cell in the body except nerve cells, actual neurons, can turn into a cancer. So it's nothing that's special about the breast tissue. There are very, very few cells that can turn into cancer. So the cancer process can basically affect all the cells of your body. If it happens to happen in the breast, then we call it a breast cancer.
And do we have any idea of why it happens in one person's breast and not the next?
Not a complete notion. In other words, we can't predict in the individual, but we know certain things predispose, such as hormones, taking postmenopausal hormone replacement therapy, maybe a accounts for a third of all breast cancers in older women. That's a very, very important factor. Radiation exposure can be a factor, but it has to be a significant amount of radiation, not the kind that you get from a mammogram, for example. Obesity is probably the next most common cause.
Well, since obesity is a growing problem in this country, does that mean that we're seeing more breast cancer?
Absolutely. There's a direct correlation between the obesity epidemic and breast cancer.
Last week, as I said earlier, the results of one of the largest ever mammogram studies published by the British Medical Journal, and it raises doubts about the ability of mammograms to save lives. Basically, it showed that death rates were the same for women with breast cancer, whether or not they got the mammograms. What are your thoughts on that study?
This is a story more about journalism than it is about science. And what I mean by that is this, is that the first thing that a scientist does when they read a report is they delve into the report and they see, you know, who did it, when did they do it, how well did they do it, and is this meaningful information that's going to affect my judgment? And not just the headline. And what you just read is the headline. And it's a big study and et cetera, and it sounds like it carries a lot of weight. This is actually a very old study. It's been reported before. This report, this recent report, was a follow-up of that study that came to the same conclusions. When the study first came out, we looked as a community very carefully at the study. It started a long time ago in the 1980s. The mammograms were just not mammograms by modern standards. And we know that because they didn't pick up tumors any smaller than were picked up by the fingers of the examining people. Well, we know that's ridiculous. Mammograms pick up very tiny cancers nowadays. They don't pick up big cancers that you could feel with your fingers. There were other things that were wrong with the study.
How do they work?
There were other things. Well, let me say, there's other things wrong with the study. And so, in fact, all of the bodies that came up with guidelines didn't use this study for the determination of guidelines. So a lot of people reading those reports, as it was reported, said this is the largest and therefore the most definitive. But it's a study that has been very highly criticized by groups of people that are independent. And it's just not germane to the modern world of modern mammography.
So you obviously believe that women should have mammograms. Everyone or only certain people? And how frequently?
It's not a matter of belief. I believe Mozart's a great conductor. That's a composer. That's belief. It's a matter of evidence. The overwhelming evidence supports not only the life-saving role for mammography, but also finding small tumors lets you conserve breasts if that's your choice, lets you avoid chemotherapy if that's appropriate. And not only that, but mammograms find precancer so that we could do things to intervene so people don't get cancer in the first place. So to actually throw mammography out of the window on the basis of this recent report would be a very silly, dangerous, and destructive thing to do.
Okay, so getting back to that, who should be getting mammograms? Everybody?
Annual mammograms starting at age 40.
Uh-huh. And how frequently? You said annual.
Once a year, right.
Is this just a form of X-ray?
It's a very, very weak X-ray, and very, very tiny. It's X-ray equivalent. If you live in Denver, for example, you're getting 2 or 3 mammograms a year just from background radiation, so that it's not a dangerous level of radiation by any stretch of the imagination. And you can see calcifications, which is a big hint. You can see masses, obviously, and now we're improving the technique so we can see abnormal blood vessels. And this is an active area of research to get it better, because we clearly know that with breast cancer, if you find it early, it makes a big difference in the management.
Well, getting back to the study, another finding was that mammograms often lead to treatment of cancer that didn't need to be treated.
Well, that's like saying that, if you get in your car and you put your seatbelt on and you don't get into an accident, that means that you put your seatbelt on unnecessarily. The fact is, you never know when you're going to get into an accident, so it's important to have a precaution. And right now, there's absolutely no way that we can tell when we see a cancer if it's going to be problematic or not. So we have to be cautious with each one. Now, there is a term that's been throwing out there a lot, and I get this a lot from people, this overdiagnosis business. You're finding cancers that would never cause trouble.
Ductal carcinoma in situ.
Well, ductal carcinoma in situ is precancer. It's not really cancer, all right? But some people are saying that some small cancers that we find with mammography would never grow and would never spread to other parts of the body if we left them alone. I've got to tell you that I've been doing this for decades and decades, and not only myself, but nobody I know has ever seen a cancer not grow. So it's a theoretical concept only. And even if that were the case, I don't know anybody who had an abnormal mammogram that showed a cancer that wouldn't treat it, even the people who are arguing that some cancers are overdiagnosed.
My guest is Dr. Larry Norton, Deputy Physician and Chief of Breast Cancer Programs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. We're talking about breast cancer on today's Please Explain, and we invite your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. Before we get to a couple of those calls and then talk about lumps and other things, it occurs to me, I didn't ask you, why would obesity make someone more likely to get cancer?
Well, the older idea is that it had to do with estrogen production from fat tissue, but the more modern idea is that it's about inflammation. Remember I mentioned that cancers are, tumors are not just cancer cells, but they're cancer cells and white cells and other cells. Well, those white blood cells are inflammatory cells. They're the kinds of cells that your body raises to fight infections. And they secrete lots of things that make things grow. That's how you heal wounds, for example. And fat tissue causes inflammation. And those that inflammation, those white cells that are produced, clearly are associated with causation and also prognosis in cancer, and not just breast, but head and neck cancer. We've shown that. My colleagues at Memorial Sloan Kettering have shown that. And this is a very, very important feature. In fact, obesity is probably one of the most important things that we could address to try to prevent cancer.
Maureen from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. One of the things that I wanted to bring up was that I now have stage 4 breast cancer. I was diagnosed in 2009 with a very small mass that was picked up by a very good catch by a radiologist with a mammogram. But so they did a lumpectomy and radiation, and they told me I'd be totally fine. This was something that couldn't be felt by the doctor, by exam. And then in 2012, I was diagnosed again with a totally different primary breast cancer that, again, was not found by a examination. The initial examination, the mammogram, the sonogram, I was going every 6 months, wasn't picked up by the PET scan. And the only thing that picked it up was an MRI. And the point that I wanted to make is that I think is so important for women to hear. If you are considered a thick-breasted woman, you are not being told when you go to get your mammographies and sonograms that those tests are only 50 to 80% reliable. So you're going along thinking everything is fine. And in fact, it's not.
Dr. Norton?
Yeah, I mean, you're raising a very important point. Now, first of all, no test is 100% perfect. And we're trying to go toward perfection. And that's why the research, our Breast Cancer Research Foundation, Memorial Sloan Kettering, and many of the bodies are trying to improve screening. But you're saying something that's very important.
But when Maureen said she's thick-breasted, dense-breasted?
Yeah, when I was talking about annual mammograms starting at age 40, I'm talking about what's called average-risk women. There are women that are at higher risk, and there's a whole variety of factors, hereditary factors, and so on. But actually having dense breasts, and that's the term, is something that does increase your risks. And we advocate strongly that people with dense breasts have other means of diagnosis in addition to mammography, not instead of mammography. An MRI right now is one of our very, very best tools. In New York State now, it's mandated by law that if a woman has a dense breast, and you can't tell that by feeling the breast, you have to look at the mammogram, that person should be notified that there may be other tools that can be used to screen the breast, and MRI is a very important one, and for lots of women, it is a lifesaver.
Thank you so much for your call. Another way that cancers are detected is through feeling a lump, but that also is not the case with all women?
Yeah, well, yes, and some types of cancers, particularly lobular cancer of the breast, are actually very, very hard to feel. But our goal is to find the cancers way before they get big enough to form lumps. And by the time they formed a lump, they've been around for a long time, probably on the average of 3 years.
That lump is just the conglomeration of cells.
And maybe only 10% of the cells in the lump are cancer cells, but they're the ones that cause the trouble.
Well, since it's late, you say, in the game, right. If a woman finds a lump, what's the next step?
Oh, every lump has to be evaluated, and that can involve mammography, MRI, but any lump, should be should be tested, should be biopsied. And as I said earlier, a core biopsy is the way to go because we can then actually see the cells and their relationship to other cells.
Now, we're going to take a little break. When we come back, we have lots of calls and we have lots more to discuss, mastectomies and whatever else is necessary in dealing with breast cancer. My guest is Dr. Larry Norton, Deputy Physician in Chief of Breast Cancer Programs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Our number 212-433-9692. You can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And we are back with Dr. Larry Norton, Deputy Physician in Chief for Breast Cancer Programs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. We're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. You can also write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or on Facebook and Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard Lopate. And lots of calls are coming in. I want to get to... Who is this? This is Ralph from Tom's River. Hi, Ralph. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, as I told the screener, my wife had breast cancer 28 years ago, and thank God she's a survivor. She's been doing great. But I wanted to talk about the aspects of possibly environmental concerns because they lived on Long Island, her family. In the 50s, they referred to the potato fields behind the house. The father passed from pancreatic cancer. The mother died of melanoma. My wife got breast cancer. Her sister got breast cancer. And I have a 28-year-old daughter, and I'm very concerned about that. And they've talked about my wife getting tested for the gene and all this other kind of stuff, and my daughter's even considered a double mastectomy. So I'm very concerned about the hereditary part of it, and that's the purpose of my call. I'll take
okay,
your response
well,
off the air.
Thank you for calling us. This reminds me of course what Angelina Jolie has done. Because she found out that she had, it was likely that she was going to develop breast cancer.
Yeah, she had a hereditary mutation, which is we do find in some individuals. And when I'm hearing this story, I'm also thinking that in addition to the environmental concerns, which were raised here, which I'll address in a second, a family with a lot of cancer and it getting genetic counseling, professional genetic counseling, would be a wise thing to do.
Now, his family didn't all have breast cancer, so does it matter if there's a one kind of cancer in one person, another kind of cancer in the other person?
It matters a lot because in hereditary syndromes, you find clusters of different kinds of cancers. So BRCA1, for example, the Angelina Jolie story is breast and ovarian cancer, but there are other familial syndromes. BRCA2 can also predispose to pancreas cancer, so that's another factor. But this takes a really individual professional consultation. On the environmental aspects, I think it's likely that there are things in our environment that are actually associated with increasing cancer incidence. Obviously, cigarette smoking is by far number one, and excessive caloric intake and obesity is up there as well. But there are probably other things as well. We've studied Long Island extensively. We haven't found a specific chemical environmental link. And I personally think that our understanding of the molecular basis for cancer and then backing off on into the environmental factors that can influence those genes is going to be a very important area of research.
Now, what determines which course of treatment is pursued? A mastectomy or whether you use whether you have a lumpectomy or what are some of the other things? Well, chemotherapy?
Radiation. There's a lot of things. You've got to think of breast cancer as two diseases, the disease in the breast and any cells that have gotten beyond that. And by breast, we consider breast and the lymph nodes under the arm as a unit. For patients who are candidates for breast conservation, that's the term we use for lumpectomy and radiation, their cure rates are exactly the same as with mastectomy. So there are reasons somebody may choose a mastectomy, but increasing your chance of being cured is not one of those reasons for most people. However, very large tumors, where the tumor is in the breast, there are a lot of other factors. Sometimes having more than one cancer in the breast will make it imperative that we have to go the mastectomy route. But it's a choice, and individuals have to make the choice. The bilateral mastectomy, which this gentleman mentioned about his daughter, is actually becoming a common operation now, and that's sort of amazing to us, those of us who in the 90s thought it was a great victory that we found that we can conserve the breast with a good cosmetic result and also have cure rates. So when one gets to these decisions, no case is like any other case, and it requires really expert consultation so that the person makes the decision that's right for them.
Now, he mentioned environmental concerns. We have heard of cancer clusters. Is it likely that somebody's drinking water or the electrical wires overhead or whatever has been blamed actually can cause these kinds of cancers?
You know, we're not finding very much, you know, we're not finding very many links there. And we're looking very, very hard. Certainly in terms of electrical wires, we're not finding anything, you know, that is a link to that area. You know, poisons, drinking water. We do know that recently there's some very serious accidents, and that kind of massive exposure to toxins certainly could have biological effects, and we have to look at that. But it's probably more likely that it's common things that we all do rather than uncommon things like poisons in the drinking water that we have to address. And the big question for us is not is it there, but how are we going to find it? And my own view is we have to start with the biology of cancer and then back off.
Well, sometimes men have breast cancer as well. Yeah. Is this process the same?
Yeah, the male breast cancer is about 1% of female breast cancer, which is still a lot. 0.11% depending upon the circumstances. So it still is an important factor. The important thing there is that men have to realize that they have breasts, and if they have a lump under their nipple, that somebody should take a look at that. That sometimes men don't think they have breasts, and so they think the lump is totally inconsequential, and they wait too long, and that's actually a very important factor in that regard. We do know that there are hereditary factors that may increase your risks of getting breast cancer if you're a man. BRCA2 in particular, mutations, and that also has to be addressed.
So if your mother had breast cancer or a close relative, you should be more aware of the possibility.
It just doesn't hurt to check into it, and there are tools that are available on websites. Memorial Sloan Kettering has one, for example, where you can go in and get some information, and you could talk to counselors on the phone who can tell you what your odds are that you're carrying a hereditary abnormality. And that is something that people could do to find out, because frankly, there are things that we could do that are preventative in that setting, and people should take advantage of that. Prevention is always better than treatment.
Does it matter whether a woman has had children or whether she's breastfed the baby?
Yeah, that's an older observation that women who don't have children or have children late, and in those days late means in the 30s, which is now becoming the more common time to have your first pregnancy. Also issues about the breastfeeding. These are relatively minor factors compared to the major factors we've been talking about. And they're not totally certain because you can't do randomized trials of when you get pregnant, for example, and that's the only way we can really find out the clear answers. So I people say, should I hurry up and have a baby now so that I can lower my risk of breast cancer? We certainly do not advise that. The if there's an effect, it's a relatively modest effect compared to the major things we've been talking about.
Jackie in New Brunswick asks if alcohol can be a risk factor.
It seems from observational studies that excessive alcohol intake actually can increase your risks. But this, we don't know whether there's a causation there, because there's an association. People who drink a lot probably do a lot of other things. And they're also taking in a lot of calories, for example. But for safety reasons in general, it's a good idea to limit your alcohol intake to no more than 2 drinks a day.
Are there ethnic or racial risks?
We do find certain factors. There's this myth, for example, that Jewish women have more breast cancer, which is just not true. It's because the Jewish population has been studied very extensively for hereditary factors, and that's the reason why somehow that's crept into the common wisdom, but it's not wise. What we do find is that African Americans, when they do get breast cancer, seem to have more aggressive breast cancer more often. And that is something that we're investigating very, very intensively as to why that is, whether that's environmental, whether that's related to some hereditary factors brought in from Africa. That actually is one of the very important areas of research that we're involved in.
Now, we talked about radiation and mastectomies. What about tamoxifen, the drug? Does that work?
Well, tamoxifen has been one of the great miracles of medicine, of medicinal chemistry, for decades and decades now, because it not only is an effective cancer treatment for tumors that depend upon estrogen, but its administration can actually lower the risks of you getting breast cancer. And there are other drugs that fall into that class, such as Evista or raloxifene. Right now it's not being prescribed for the general population for generally, but certainly in specific situations, it's a good idea to think about those kinds of medicines. The most important thing about that, however, is the proof that you can do things to lower your risk, chemically do things to lower your risk. And we are actively searching for even better ways than tamoxifen to do that.
Well, despite all of these things, 40,000 people or so die every year from breast cancer.
Right.
So the treatments are only iffy?
Well, they're not perfect. I mean, they're better than they have been, and we see declining death rates from breast cancer percentage-wise. Remember, the population is also increasing during that period of time. So we're seeing declining breast cancer death rates. Every place in the world that's instituted modern breast cancer management, which includes modern treatment but also modern screening.
Let's take a call from Amy from Queens. Hi, you're on the air.
I'm actually a cancer survivor and was diagnosed at 38 and was treated at Sloan Kettering and was a wonderful facility, loved all my doctors there. But I wanted to ask you if you're seeing a higher incidence of women under 40 being diagnosed with breast cancer, and all these studies seem to focus on telling people over 40 to get mammograms, but what should women under 40 do?
Well, the best thing to do yes, indeed, we are seeing, you know, increasing rates of breast cancer really across the board in all populations. That includes younger women. The reason why we're not recommending mammograms under 40 is because breasts are dense because of natural breast tissue at that age, and so the mammograms aren't very useful. Also, we don't like to go lower than 25 because the breasts are still developing. And the radiation exposure might be more risky than when breasts are fully developed after age 25. The most important thing you can do if you're younger is, first of all, be aware of your risks. If you have any kind of suggestion of hereditary risks, check into it. Avoid obesity, exercise regularly, don't take hormones if you don't have to. I think it's a good idea for women to know what their breasts feel like. So self-examination is a mixed bag. It has not been ever proven to be beneficial, but I still think it's useful for women to know what their breasts feel like. And also, you need a health professional to examine you on a regular basis.
What about estrogen therapies for people, for women who have been going through menopause?
You know,
does that increase the risk?
Absolutely. Of this, there is absolutely definitive proof, and that's because we have randomized trials that were concluded in the early 2000s, 2002, that clearly showed increased risk, particularly from the combination of estrogen and progesterone. And frankly, I know no postmenopausal symptoms that can't be treated better with safer medications than hormone replacement therapy.
What about just soy, as some people have suggested?
Well, you know, the only thing we can say definitively about soy, we can say two things. First of all, we've just completed a study supported by the Breast Cancer Research Foundation at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, showing that soy does have effects on breast tissue that actually can be measured. The one thing we
positive
can say
effects?
For sure, that remains to be determined. We know that eating soy is in its natural form, in the amounts that they eat in Asia, is not increasing your risks. Whether it's effective for decreasing your risks is really not known. Soy has something called phytoestrogens in it, which are more like tamoxifen than estrogen. In other words, it has an estrogen and an anti-estrogen effect. And that is something else that deserves more study.
What about turmeric, am I pronouncing it right?
Yeah.
I'm told has cut down on cancer rates in India because it's a part of the diet.
Well, it's actually in the diet and it tastes great and it's an important part of the food. But as a cancer preventative, I would not put too much stock in that because, again, observation does not relate to causation. And unless you have a randomized trial where you start in childhood with some groups eating turmeric and other people not, and then you look at the rates, you can't make a statement unless you have such data, and nobody's ever going to have such data.
Ennis from Wayne. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, how you doing? I don't want to waste a lot of time. My question is two parts. The first part is, do you think screening x-rays and CAT scans, like for example, for other cancers, would increase the risk of breast cancer? And the other question is, there's a recent study that showed that the physical exam is as good as mammograms in detecting breast cancer. So if you can a little bit elaborate on that and if you're convinced with it or not. And thank you so much for the education.
I'll do both fairly quickly. First of all, CAT scans deliver a lot more radiation than mammography. I mean, a dramatically more increase. But and probably having too many CAT scans in your life may increase your risk by a little tiny bit.
But isn't that a problem when you've had cancer and they say the only way we can detect whether it has metastasized is to give you a CAT scan?
Not at all. I mean, we're talking about a lot of CAT scans increasing risk by a very tiny amount. I mean, so we have to really put things in perspective. And knowing how the best way to treat the cancer is overwhelmingly more important for that individual than any risks associated with the CAT scans. And remember, even that's theoretical. Nobody's ever shown objectively that there's increased risk. If it is, it's really very, very tiny. On the notion of the last comment that physical exam is as good as mammography, you're referring to that how we started the segment here, that particular study. And that would basically says that really poor mammograms are as bad as physical examination. And so it's not saying that physical examination is good. It's saying if you don't have a good mammogram, it's as bad as a detection method as physical examination. So what we're talking about are really excellent mammograms and MRIs, for example, for certain individuals, and that's a totally different situation.
Now, a listener with a suspicious mind says cancer is big business and medical science really doesn't want to cure it.
Yeah, well, you'd have to tell that to all my physician scientist friends who've died of breast cancer.
We go now to Richard from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm a cell biologist at the Downstate Medical Center, and I work with my colleague Eugene Fine at Einstein, studying the effect of low carbohydrate diets on cancer. The rationale is that whereas inflammation seems to be certainly relevant, an additional possibility is the role of insulin, and along these lines, the disruption in insulin metabolism would affect risk of cancer and obesity in parallel. In other words, there is always the danger with associations of saying that one causes the other, whereas both cancer and obesity may have a common cause. And so I think that's very important. I don't think we do have the problem that there's been a longstanding resistance to dietary carbohydrate restriction as a therapy.
Dr. Norton?
Yeah, I mean, what you're basically saying is we need much more research on cancer causation and follow up all available leads. And I could not applaud more the notion that we need much more research. You know, when you look at how much we spend as a world and as a nation, because the United States is the leading researcher in this regard, compared to the magnitude of the problem, it's just overwhelming. National Cancer Institute budget, about $5 billion. Philanthropy about another billion, industry
despite
about
all of those
billion.
Pink ribbons.
Yeah, you know, but we're talking about $10 to $11 billion total, and that's not just breast cancer, that's all cancers all put together. And those of you who've been reading the newspapers about expenditures for various things, I mean, we're talking about for a disease that's going to affect 1/3 to a half of us, to spend that much money to try to find all the causation, all the therapy, all the detection. I mean, that's why we're not making progress. And I think that's something that the public really has to know. They think that an enormous amount is being spent on cancer research, and it's a drop in the bucket compared to what the needs are.
Do you see any promising therapies that are on the horizon?
Well, that's one of the most important things. There's so much that's happening that's exciting now and that people have to know about. Immune therapies, turning your immune system to your friend in that regard. Targeted therapies, attacking the molecules that actually make the cancer cancerous, for example, is very important. Ways of interfering with the relationship between the cancer cell and its microenvironment is very important, and so on and so on. This is probably one of the most exciting times in all of biomedical history in terms of making advances, and it's important for the public to support that, as well as, forgive me for the plug, supporting this radio station, which is beloved, and my wife and I have been members forever and intend to be members forever, and I appreciate the opportunity to have this conversation.
It's the only reason we invited you on the show, not because you're deputy physician in chief for breast cancer programs at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Thank you so much for being on our show.
I really appreciate
being such a great guest on today's Please Explain.
Thank you so much.
Larry Norton.